Leiden und von Main, von Tausend wird ihr klappen und kritzen mit die Zehn.
Da klappt der Gloss und Gläser und nimmt das Weibel Reisen und geht mit mir an den Zollerder Fahrt.
Welcome to the Minyan. We are joined here today with Electronic Intifada. Woo-hoo! I am a big fan, big fan. I am Talia. We are your Talmudic tankies. Things have been pretty crazy this summer. As you know, we have lost our abortion rights. Some Jews are bringing a lawsuit. They say it's against their freedom of religion, which I 100% agree with. Things are slipping more and more into fascist territory. Prez, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi. If you are listening to this, you probably already know me.
Yeah, that's about it, right?
We are joined by Nora.
Hello. I'm really, really excited to be on this podcast. I think you guys are great. And yeah, I think Justin Podor over at the Anti-Empire Project connected us. So I'm grateful for him as always and all of you.
Thank you. It's so great to have you here. We have Dan.
Yeah, more in the sort of like Friends of the Anti-Empire Project coterie. But anyway, very pleased to be here.
And Dan and I are long-time friends too. So it's always
I'm a longer time fan. I sort of did Campus Palestine work with Nora's reporting in my ear back in the day.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I think Electronic Intifada has like impacted a lot of us.
It's true, but this was Flashpoints days, you know. Oh.
Ancient history.
Big inspiration. So there's a lot to talk about, but I think the most recent thing is Biden's trip to Occupy Palestine and how that was, how that went. I was really shocked by him saying, like, his brain just melted and he said, like, a fact saying, quote, "My background, the background of my family is Irish American, and we have a long history not fundamentally unlike the Palestinian people with Great Britain and their attitude toward Irish Catholics over the years for 400 years. And if anyone knows and anyone listens to this podcast, they know that the connection between Ireland and Palestine runs very, very deep. And to have him just like come out with the truth, it's just crazy to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, you said it correctly. I think his brain did melt and he said something that he knew he wasn't supposed to, like his handlers probably said, don't say anything about Irish, you know, the Irish struggle against British colonialism and how it relates to Palestinian struggle against Israeli colonialism. Like, don't say that. And of course, like when you think of, you know, when you say, don't think of an elephant, you think of an elephant. So I don't know, like that was, it was like a very strange, like, wait a second. And I was surprised that like his handlers didn't, you know, scuttle him off stage immediately, like with the hook and the, you know, the gong sound. Yeah.
Imposing Biden on that primary process did just like land in the White House a total dud. And it's phenomenal. Like in terms of public diplomacy, it's just epic. And it has been since the inauguration, right? It's just like consistent. And every once in a while, it's like, are you just playing this? And there's some really bright playing dumb game that's going on. And it's seeming less and less like it.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
Yeah. It's pretty spectacular.
It's like, I don't know. There are times where I think, how could he sound worse than Trump? And then he does. And it's just, but he does it with a smile. And since he's blue,
right,
all the liberals just eat it up. Right. And it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, continuing the same policies as Trump, who continued the same policies as Obama, who continued the policies of, you know, like it goes down the line, especially when we're talking about foreign policy and especially around Israel. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone who thought that we were going to get anything different or better under Biden, completely delusional. I mean, the amount of just devastating rollbacks of civil liberties and, you know, of course, like, you know, the fight for the right to have an abortion and, you know, healthcare in this country is, it couldn't be worse. And of like you said, like the liberals, they had, you know, they had this ghoul in the White House under Trump that they could pretend that they were an opposition party to. And now they're just, you know, going back to what they were wanting to do, just like have brunch while the world burns. It's pretty sad. Pretty sad over here.
And they're still dumping off busloads of migrants in DC and other places. And Trump was doing that. And now Biden's saying he's going to finish the border wall. And I hear nothing.
He got Mexico to pay for it.
Oh my God.
He literally did what Trump was promising. It's amazing.
And the silence from liberals is deafening.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty dismal.
So, I mean, I'm not in the States, but your sense is that lucky sort of the Democratic machine of co-optation is not even like, I mean, I know it's fraying in significant ways. And it seems to me that, you know, the enthusiasm that there was around, say, the Obama project is not nowadays anywhere replicated, but it still seems to you that there's not much pushback.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, they're just telling us to vote harder.
Yeah.
It's true because they do such a good job when they're in, right? We see the fruits.
It's just amazing.
Get me a mansion t-shirt, you know?
Exactly. I mean, that's it though. They can always blame, you know, like when you say, well, why didn't they codify Roe? Why didn't they, you know, enact Medicare for All, which is a very popular program? Why didn't they, you know, forgive student loan debt, which was also a very popular policy that they can enact? And so, well, they can't actually do it because of Manchin and Sinema and, you know, the Republicans. But they have the majority. I mean, why can't they kick Manchin out of the Senate? Why can't they do a thing? Why can't they do any? What good is having Democratic control of the White House and both houses of Congress if they can't do anything and we're just supposed to like roll over and vote again? It's pretty bleak, but it's also like, I mean, at least they're being honest about the way that the system has always worked, that it is an oligarchy, you know, for corporations. It is, you know, bipartisan support for all the things that we hate. And it just keeps getting clearer and clearer that this is what America has always been about.
Yeah. And the Democrats are just using all of this horrific stuff that they're letting slide just as fundraising.
Yeah.
They just fundraise off of it, much like how the ADL just fundraises off of what they deem anti-Semitic attacks.
Yeah. I think the Democrats raised like $50 million or something since Roe v. Wade was stricken down.
Nice. So that Nancy Pelosi can like buy another yacht. Like what's
for $12 a pint ice cream.
Exactly.
Oh, right. Don't get me started on that Jenny's ice cream.
A nightmare.
It has connections to Jeffrey Epstein and it just blows my mind every time I think about it. I just, I
hate it. They're all monsters.
Internationally, at least, I think it's becoming a little more obvious, though. I mean, I'm remembering back in the day when it was like Malcolm X and others talking about the Goldwater campaign and saying that the function of the Goldwater campaign was really to rally people behind sort of, you know, among other things, a Democratic Party that was not delivering. And it's just wild that like literally Hillary Clinton was working with the Goldwater campaign in the late 60s before then pretending to be the other pole of this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just the way they're rolling out is so textbook, where then there's like far right resurgence. Tom Friedman comes out in the New York Times saying we should have now a Democratic Party led by Cheney and Biden. It's like,
did he, was that actually a thing?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Like the headline was saying to the effect of Cheney Biden 2024. This was before the sort of rumblings of Biden is not going to work as our front man. We're getting louder. I'm not sure how they're going to deal with that, but like,
they're not going to, they're just going to, you know, it's going to be like Weekend at Bernie's. in 2024. They're just going to roll him out. Pump him full of amphetamine so that he, you know, says a coherent sentence and then roll him back, you know, into the into
That's
the
hopeful.
I don't know.
He'll say
I don't
more
know.
About Palestinian-Irish struggle.
It's just, I mean, it's an interesting politics, right? The Irish one, because it's precisely that, like, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was really the one back in the heyday of the Palestinian liberation struggle and third world support for it that pioneered this sort of new anti-Semitism stuff, mm-hmm. where his whole point with this, so what was it, benign neglect? Anyway, his attempt in New York to depict the Black Power movement as anti-Semitic because affirmative action is just coming for the ethnic minorities or the whatever, the Euro ethnics as they called them, mm-hmm. then just extended into, okay, the United Nations is anti-Semitic. And that's sort of like attempt to capture histories of Irish marginalization as a weapon to attack Black and third world struggles was so wrapped up with another narrative that you think Biden could at least like remember that line instead of going to something more genuine.
Yeah. You think that. Whoops.
Whoops.
Moynihan was a piece of shit.
Yeah.
They made us learn about his whole report stuff in undergrad, and it was just horrible. Did a whole study.
Makes for a creepy read.
Yeah.
Would you like to expand on that? Because I don't know much about it.
Moynihan was before he was a politician, he was a social researcher. And his big thing, the Moynihan Report, was essentially like describing why the Black family is incapable of properly raising a child.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Okay.
And yeah, it's not great. It set the stage for the whole third way kind of social research that we need to look at the social and economic context, but blame it all on the people we're looking at.
So just ignore the class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never actually interrogate any of the systemic issues ever.
Yeah.
And it's also like a big landmark for sort of just white supremacist politics in the sense that like the original American white nationalist model is anybody who's free white persons, like mm-hmm. free white persons in the language of the first naturalization act of the late 18th century, was sort of white. But there is this Anglo-Saxon thing where like Jews and Irish, though white in that original white nationalist sense, occupied this weird space.
Mm-hmm.
And the politics of New York after World War II in particular, as the civil rights movement comes north, involves the Catholic and Jewish blocs being sort of joined to the old, like old regime Anglo-Saxondom to smash at the Black liberation struggle. Mm-hmm. So it's big for Nixon, this thing of, you know, I forget who was one of these New York mayoral candidates in the same period, like shouting down people in Harlem being like, my soul is as black as yours. I'm Italian. We've all faced discrimination. Oh, shut up, God. Sort of thing. Like Moynihan headed up that. And like the anti-Semitism and legacy of anti-Irish racism and legacy of anti-Italian stuff, like all of that got wrapped up in this whole fight for Euro ethnics being a new packaging for white backlash politics, right?
Hmm. It's very interesting.
Which is a wordier way of saying, yeah, Moynihan's a piece of shit.
He was an advisor for Nixon too, but he played Democrat the rest of his career.
They're just one and the same. There's no difference. Yeah, no. They're both capitalist political parties.
That becomes clearer and clearer every election cycle.
Yeah. And I just wish people would wake up to it. Like most liberals, I just wish they would like see Biden is no different than Trump. At least we had abortion under Trump. Now we have nothing. Now they're taking away even more things under Trump, under Biden. They're just the same to me at this point.
Exactly. I mean, there's not a category like you can't. I don't know. I mean, people were like getting stimulus checks under Trump, and there's been nothing like that under Biden. You know, like the material conditions for most people in this country have gotten worse in the last 2 years.
They really have.
It's really bad. It's really bad.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like there is this distinctive white power resurgence that's linked to the Trump project.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of coalition politics on the right wing of which, on the far right of which, are like, you know, out and out Nazis or whatever. That, how that plays out, like it's very good cop, bad cop, but it's also very weird in the sense that like a chunk of that sort of US focused white power politics is almost willing to forego leadership of the world if they can be more nasty at home. But that is the upshot. Like, you can't do all of this. You can't wage war on women in the States, wage war on Black people, like, just smash as hard as you can. And I do think there's a vibe in the Democratic Party that wants more strategically to rein some of that in. So some of it's good cop, bad cop, but some of it also reads to me like empire in decline, dysfunction, where no one can figure out quite what to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the attacks on trans people and LGBT people are just getting worse and worse too. Yeah. They're just waging war against everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, kind of logistic civil rights stuff, you know, just like abortion that we've come to, you know, take for granted as like a matter of healthcare policy. I mean, I wrote a thing the other week about how the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in the US decided to overturn a ruling that was made last year that said, you know, the ruling kind of upheld the right of boycotts, economic, you know, boycotts as a fundamental right under the First Amendment. And they said, you know, boycotts are protected as free speech. It's a political opinion. You know, there was the Montgomery bus boycotts that, you know, were kind of held up as like, this is a prime example of why people should be able to boycott an entity, you know, because of violations of civil or human rights. Mm-hmm. And the Eighth Circuit Court overturned that decision. And now it goes to the Supreme Court, which, as we know, is,
I
know, right? So like in the next, I don't know, year, 2 years, 3 years, we could have the right to political boycotts being struck down, just as the right to abortion as healthcare being struck down. This time we're in, the people who are in charge, these unelected, you know, monsters in the Supreme Court. I mean, things are coming down the pike. And yeah, and like you said, like trans rights, queer rights, it's just, you know, the right for people to be able to adopt kids if, you know, they're a queer couple. Like, it just, I don't know. I don't know how we're going to get out of this without like revolution.
I mean, Rosa did write something about that.
She sure did. She sure did. And she was not the only one. Yeah.
I'm never going to get over the fact that there's an entire book written about how Rosa actually wrote about reform being good.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Well, like reform. Like reformist reforms being good?
Yeah.
She did. Yeah. I didn't.
Who wrote
that?
I forget the actual name of the author, but she's the one who wrote Women Had Better Sex Under Socialism.
Oh. Well, she obviously did not actually read Reform or Revolution.
Wow. Wow. That's like Elon Musk saying that he read Marx's book on capitalism called Capitalism. I think that's what he's
awesome.
Yeah, I wanna about the adoption. There was a case that was just decided upon. I hope it's being appealed now, but a Jewish couple was trying to adopt from a Christian adoption agency and they weren't allowed to. And the court ruled, well, if there is another type of adoption agency that will adopt out to a Jewish couple, then it's okay.
Right, right.
Everybody equal as
well. Yeah, exactly. Jim Crow everywhere. Yeah.
Just the blatant anti-Semitism that we're getting back to. It's just the, it's not great. No. Not great at all. No. And
right. And like the institutions that were ostensibly set up to protect Jews in this country from anti-Semitism are too busy shutting down Palestine solidarity events and exactly. smearing you know, Jewish anti-Zionists as racists to get involved with actual cases of anti-Semitism. It's pretty nuts.
Yeah. And it's that boycott case you were talking about, was that attached to the BDS?
I mean, it was, you know, kind of tangentially. It came out of a case in Arkansas, of all places, where a publisher of a local newspaper, you know, like a historical artifact that is a newspaper, was going through the process of getting contracts for advertisers. This was a couple of years ago. And one of the advertisers was like the state college. And in order to accept the advertisement from the state college, the publisher had to sign essentially a loyalty oath to the state of Israel, basically saying that, you know, because this was a state contract, he wouldn't promote the BDS movement or engage with the BDS movement, you know, during the terms of this contract. And he was like, you know, that smells fishy to me. Yes. We are a publication. Why am I? He said something like, you know, once you sign that kind of oath, you're not in the publishing business, you're in the propaganda business or something like that. And so he took it to court and he won. And the law was slightly amended, I believe. This happens frequently with these, like, you know, state anti-BDS laws, is that like a case is brought showing that they harm people. And then the Israel lobby gets involved. They helped legislators rewrite the law to say that it only applies to like businesses of more than 100 employees or like contracts over $100,000, something, you know, crazy like that. But the law is still on the books. And so I think they slightly amended the law, but now the Eighth Circuit Court has overturned it. So it goes to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not it is constitutional to have a political opinion on signing a loyalty oath to a foreign state.
Yeah, this doesn't really
it's help. Not good.
Doesn't help Jews' case in that dual loyalty business either.
Sure doesn't. Right? Like it's so absurd. And it's like they're doing this for some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, like shenanigans. It's so bad. It's so bad.
I just want off this ride.
I know, right?
It's not fun. Yeah. No,
exactly. delete.
I do think, though, that it's very, again, textbook, and in a way that extends beyond Jewish community politics, in the sense that, like, the anti-Semitism stuff blew my mind for a while. But honestly, in some ways, like the archetypical case is slavery, right? Like, it's wild that the scramble for Africa and white power politics through the like late 19th and early 20th century in their heyday were articulated as anti-slavery, right? Mm-hmm. Like the line was, we need to stamp out the Arab slave trade. And it was this same sort of Semitic menace nonsense, where the imposition of forced labor by European powers in Africa was in some twisted way framed in the name of abolitionism. And I think like the way that this particular beast of like Anglo-racist politics works is every single thing that gets lobbed at it, it tries to twist against its enemies. And I think anti-Semitism, like the whole new anti-Semitism BS, has as much to do with that. And it's almost becoming a caricature of itself, where like outside of white supremacist language, you've got some possible freedom. You know, they say, we are the people, we have freedom, like every single significant concept they try to take for themselves. Then you've got, you know, a Swahili word like Uhuru, which is trying to escape out of that sort of mess and create some independent language. And it literally is adopted by the Proud Boys as one of the Proud Boys like tattoo slogans, right? And I think there's something about the obviousness of this game of trying to take everything over and twist it against itself, that in its overambitiousness and clumsiness is becoming vulnerable. And I think like, and some level we can just get lost in it. But I think if we try to step back, there is space for popular education, for people to get a sense that this is garbage. Because just like the week before last, there came out this poll of, I think, like a bunch of G7 countries where huge majorities of the workforce are like, what we're being fed are lies. And I think, you know, something like three quarters of employees being like, the racial equity policies we've got in this workplace are just performative nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this weird thing going on where traditional liberal expert liars for the US ruling class are trying to cry post-truth, but just spinning their own liberal inconsistencies. And there's a real, I think, popular hunger for sort of the analytical tools to figure out where the lies are coming from. So I do think there's hope in this mess, if only because it's getting so bad that people are looking for why.
Yeah.
So optimistic.
You have to keep that. You have to keep the optimism up, even though it like seems horrible right now.
Yeah.
You know, I always like, I just went to Paris for the first time this summer, and the French Revolution is like something that means a lot to me. And just thinking about how, you know, things are really, really terrible for them, and they did the impossible. They like, they took down something that they thought was ordained by God because things were so bad. And I just hope that we get to this point where we take down the thing that is basically God to the ruling class, which is money. We have to take, I really hope that we get to this point while I'm still alive.
Right? Exactly.
This is horrible.
Yeah. 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 It's amazing. That was like when I was first kind of diving into history of, you know, communism and Marxism and all the different revolutions over the last, you know, 200-300 years, like the commune, the actual commune in Paris after the revolution, I think it lasted only what, like 50 days or something.
Yeah.
It was a very, very short period of time. And it sparked this, you know, just like this thing that's now lasted since this idea of we can do something different, and we don't have to suffer under this, you know, oppressive monarchy, or, you know, now it's a capitalist oligarchy. Mm-hmm. Like, we can take matters into our own hands and the people will follow. It's just kind of, you know, it's incredible. And then you think about like the Chinese Revolution, and it was like 16 people going on, you know, the long march, developing cadre in the villages. And it's just kind of like, you know, we think we're so marginalized and alienated and kind of alone, but when you read about the history of these other revolutions, I mean, the Cubans, right, they were in the mountains for a year. There were only, you know, a couple dozen, and you know, they were able to overthrow a US backed dictatorship. Like,
so good,
right? Like those are things. Like, okay, all right. We like, yes, optimism. It's not just like, you know, kind of an empty optimism. It's like these are the people who taught us, and they want, you know, they want us to believe in something bigger than ourselves at this point. Yeah, I mean, that's what gives me. Like it's what kind of pulls me out of the pit of despair that I find myself in 99% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just got to read some Marx and Mao, and you'll start to feel a little better.
Exactly.
Like, these or people, even I Ho mean, Chi Minh. He like
exactly. I mean, look France at the Vietnamese,
and the US. Right?
I mean, come on. Incredible. Incredible. And they did it because they had to, and they believed in a better world for themselves and their kids.
Mm-hmm.
But above and beyond even like the whole, whatever, like pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will stuff, I think there is something weird, sort of emotional and psychological going on, in the sense that like in the 90s, the system and the dominant culture were strong enough that you could plug into it and it would feel right, even if you knew it wasn't, in a way. And there's less and less space for that. But I do think that's because it's sort of weakening and becoming less functional. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easy to experience that as a deterioration when it really is a weakening of a system that needs fundamentally to change. So like there's all sorts of dangers and instabilities, but I think there really are grounds for hope. in the sort of multi-century sense of this is not an empire that's going to last forever. And the global reconfigurations aren't just future tense, like they're happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. I think that if Bernie had ended up running and winning the Democratic primary in either the last two elections, I think we would have had a Obama style like rehabilitation of the Democratic Party, which would have made all of the people who are kind of either falling out with the Democrats in the strict sense or also kind of starting to fall out with the DSA, which hasn't been able to really accomplish anything since it became kind of mainstream 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I just feel so old.
I'm speaking mostly out of like an intellectual standpoint, because I was too young to really be around for Obama's first like hope and change thing. Mm-hmm. So I think we would have had something similar to that.
I think you're right,
Bernie. But I like it. The Democrats are too. There's too much of a dedication to the kind of neoliberal hegemony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And who knows how much Bernie would have sold out and really like shown that he was like another Obama, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, I was really excited about the Bernie campaign. I was working in some of the outreach stuff for months. I've never been excited about a Democratic Party candidate ever in my life, ever. Like I've always, if I voted, I voted, you know, for the Green Party or for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. But I was like, okay, there's, you know, he won Nevada. That's never happened, you know, to someone kind of outside the, you know, neoliberal Democratic Party. Like we have a chance. We have all these people, you know, who are really incredible leftists and socialists, like really getting behind this campaign. All right, let's see what we can do. And like the sense of betrayal, yeah. I think that we all felt when Bernie, you know, threw his weight behind. I mean, they all ganged up on him and they made him throw his weight behind Hillary. Was it Hillary? No, I can't remember.
Yeah,
it was Hillary.
It was Hillary.
The most insane decision. She's run like what, three times?
Exactly. Now? And
she's
then
probably going to come back too.
Right. And then like behind that. Biden, you know, 4 years later, like it just, the Democratic Party itself is such a machine that if he had legitimately won, you know, the nomination and then the presidency, it's, I don't know, to me, it's like they would have tried, the party itself would have tried everything to stop any agenda in its tracks. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, like getting behind Medicare for All, are you kidding me? Like she would never.
No.
After 2020 with Bernie, like selling out to Biden, I was like, okay, that's it. I think we have to, if we're going to enact any sort of like political change in, you know, from within this country, we have to think of entirely different strategies than just kind of going along with electoral politics. Mm-hmm. But I don't even know what those strategies are yet. I don't know. Like it's so tough.
Well, some people have written about those strategies.
Yep. True. Some people have.
I think the biggest limitation, though, is just how fragmented the U.S. left is.
Yeah.
Because we have, even among the socialists, we have like five or six different parties and then a bunch of others that are just opportunistically using the language.
Yeah.
Which, it's a mess.
Which like distract people from actually joining a real one.
Right.
And then you have the DSA.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have the DSA, which has been so watered down. I mean, just the way that they treated the Palestine caucus.
I think they did reinstate them. Yeah. Reinstate it. Yeah.
But it was like so terribly handled.
It really was.
And they did it, you know, in order to support, you know, this one congressman, Jamal Bowman, who I don't know what he's done for the DSA. I don't know if he's followed any of the party platforms and enacted any sort of material change for people, but they decided to take a stand that a lot of people left the DSA for. My mom like wrote a very strongly worded letter to the DSA after they kicked out the Palestine caucus.
Her mom sounds super cool.
My mom was pretty cool. She was very, very upset.
Oh man.
And she was like, and they never even wrote me back. Checks out.
Hey Dan, do you want to talk about your Nazi stuff?
Well, I mean, I think it all links in.
We'll figure out how to like segue.
Well, no, but I mean, the segue is natural enough in the sense that like.
I'll cut that out.
One of the things that, no, keep it. It's legit. It's genuine. Authenticity. It's the marketing buzzword of the year, you know? I mean, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about pretty much everything that's shoved down our throats. But that like Nazism and fascism and all this stuff, because I mean, I think we use these words in ways that are sometimes a little bit reflexive and confused, right? Like the complaints of Italy and Germany were precisely that they were not central participants in the defining white power process of carving up the rest of the world. So to look at the particular assault on reason in Italy and the reason it latches on to like the fasces, this old Italian slogan, that this old Italian symbol that you can find on like whatever 19th century US currency, there's nothing especially special about it. Similarly, in Germany, because the white power motto is steal what your enemy's attacking you with and bring it to your side, they're like, we're fighting a socialist movement. No. Socialism, you're looking at an international socialism that's Jewish. We're a national socialist, and they call themselves Nazis. So like, that's fine. But one of the key points is that these guys looked up to the Anglos as sort of the elder statesmen in the room, right? It was precisely what was done with the actual histories of enslavement and cross-continental conquest that they were into. So it's weird to just look, for example, at a book like The Passing of the Great Race by Madison Grant as American as apple pie, which Hitler described as his Bible, but which was written in New England, right? Or like the concept of the underman, the Untermensch, being written by Grant's protege, Lothrop Stoddard, all of which is like in a few clicks readable nowadays, right? So I think some of what's weird is, for very strategic reasons, open white power politics are less effective than are sublimated, smile in your face, screw you over subtly. Like stuff that actually works and gets in the heads of the people you're oppressing, right? And I think some of what's happening is that as the sublimated, seems all naturalized white power make-believe starts to come apart, you have a lot of people who are discovering the original literature and doing vintage white power politics in a way that is dangerous and reprehensible, but also really, I think, amateurish, in the sense that what worked at a particular phase of history where the power of Western Europeans in relationship to the rest of the world was like distinct and not replicable is not going to work now. So I actually think that like, if you read the contemporary neo-Nazi literature, which is like super, super plain spoken, they're trying to convert implicit intergenerational whiteness into an explicit white power politics, in a context where I actually don't think that's a particularly good power play for the coming decades. So where that leaves us is super unclear, but like, I do think that we need to sort of try to pull ourselves out of decade by decade and move more towards century by century thinking, in the sense that like, when they're screaming blood and soil in Charlottesville, like early Virginia in like American Revolution days, Edmund Burke is saying that freedom of the blood is the reason that you're freer when you're enslaving someone. And it's George Wallace or whoever in the 60s who's talking about freedom, loving blood and all this nonsense, right? So like, I think what has been hidden by the triumph of a particular normalized, technically boring capitalist politics is a really horrific history that they did a good job hiding. And the way that they're dredging it up to try to mobilize their base, I don't think is going to have predictable consequences or ones that play in their favor.
That was really solid. That's a really solid analysis. It's something I had never thought about before.
Just to drop some names, because I'm just like, these guys, it's a make-believe politics, and they're open that it's make-believe. Like, the one of the real Anglo myths is that something that's boring must therefore be rational. And it's a problem because, like, the super epochal, like, lightning from the sky Nazi or fascist models, like, they don't like truth. But the idea that just boring commerce trumps truth is also based on lies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did such an effective job of that, that I genuinely think they've forgotten what was involved in that operation. I really think that one of the things that exists with the particular demonological approach to Nazism, where it's literally like an old crusading model of think of them as demons, don't read them, mm-hmm. is if you actually read the Nazis, they're just so dull and straightforward. Like, it's a line by line how-to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we're just constantly referring to the English as the people who know how to do it. So again, what that ends up meaning becomes quite significant, because the key problem, like the key thing that, for example, Hitler was a dumbass for not getting, was he understood that the surface of racist and imperial language hides the reality. Fine. You know, Mazel tov. Incidentally, the portion of Mein Kampf in which Hitler refers to the importance of looking behind the surface of language is a tribute to the last Liberal Party prime minister in Britain, Lloyd George, who is not horrified by being praised in Mein Kampf, but returns the favor by advocating for Hitler in the late 1930s while people are fighting the British Union of Fascists in the streets in London.
Mm.
But in any case, what Hitler didn't get is looking at this myth of white power politics. He's like, oh, okay, you get drunk on your own superiority. But what the people who did it, the English, the French, learned is that it's bullshit. You're actually not superior to the people you're oppressing. You have to do an elaborate smoke and mirrors game, not get high on your own supply, and screw with the mind of the colonized as much as with the mind of the colonizer. Because mm-hmm. if you've got a super whipped up white power only base, they're going to get their asses defeated internationally. And I feel like this, from the perspective even of like the most crass, cynical US statecraft, is some of what's going on. You just can't be this nasty and win.
Why does it feel like they're winning?
Though, yeah.
In so many ways, like, you know, maybe, I don't, I mean, in Canada, you had the convoy, right? Like,
yeah,
these like national, white nationalist wackadoos terrorizing entire communities around mm-hmm. the you know, the major cities, like
towards yeah. the end in Hitler's bunker, when his spirits were, you know, falling apart because he was about to lose. Goebbels says in his diary, to the extent that you can, there's a sentence, to the extent that you can trust Goebbels. But anyway, Goebbels in his,
Jesus.
Goebbels in his
These
diary.
These are lines that have never been said on this podcast.
but I mean, I think this is a significant point. Goebbels claims in his diary to have read to Hitler from Thomas Carlyle's biography of Frederick the Great in order to buoy his spirits. Carlyle was so openly prefigured Nazi politics that when the Nazis seized power in 1933, one of the big Scottish academic lecture series, the Adamson series, published a lecture, Carlyle and Hitler, looking at the comparison, right? This is significant in the sense that if you look, say, to Ralph Waldo Emerson, Emerson identifies Carlyle as the undisputed English head of letters and points in particular to his book, Sartor Restoris or something, The Tailor Patched, as the most influential book in the New England of his day. And Carlyle was a proto-Nazi thinker, but where he, and particularly his disciples, took this even more sophisticated. One of the problems with racism is that it actually feels nasty to be killing people. So Carlyle actually was a little too extreme for this, but his disciples, where Carlyle was big, is he's like, don't talk about your racism, try to hide stuff. He was good at irony and hiding. The key, though, is if you can find a way to feel good, even as you're exploiting people, it's better for you psychologically, right? Like, it may be nice to steal someone's land and kill them, but if you can do that and also have the chemical responses in your body that correspond to feelings of fulfilled altruism, that's like the golden ticket, right? And that is where the real masters at this stuff play. So in Canada, for example, like nice guy reputation, thousands of murdered Indigenous children buried mm-hmm. around residential schools mm-hmm. in a system that expressly was designed to help them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and like you take, say, Rudyard Kipling, whose name graces the westernmost point of the Toronto subway system. This is a guy whose language inspired the principal publicist for the Ku Klux Klan, mm-hmm. a guy whose anti-immigrant rants you can read on YouTube right now, you can listen to on YouTube in things like The Stranger or The Wrath of the Awakened Saxon, in which white power groups today on YouTube talk about how Saxon hatred is a hatred where you won't even see the bullets coming because we'll talk nice, or in the words of the Proud Boys, we have boys in our name, we seem nice, but we'll assassinate mm-hmm. you, and they look back. But that's a big deal, right? There's an irony in saying that out loud, which is a problem. And what's happening partly is where that sublimated racism could be assumed. Now you have people saying, okay, if you are saying you don't like that you killed Native people, then are we going to do anything about land claims? Where things become more specific, or in the States, where it's like, on some level, there's a deterioration, but partly it's you cannot be racist in the way that you could in the 90s in the mainstream culture without pushback.
Mm-hmm.
And the improvement, whatever, we're such a bloody commie group here.
Go for it.
Old language, like, there really is a dialectic between the sharpened articulation of racism and anti-racist gains mm-hmm. in the same sense that, like, Hitlerian racism, for all of its horror, was a last-ditch attempt to maintain a white power order that was defeated in that struggle. So I do think that there's a sense in which often signs of the sharpened articulation of racism and the tumult and visibility that comes with the flailing of a white power politics that no longer can be unspoken is nasty, and I'm not like, let's encourage it. But when it's happening, I think it's also important not to buy into what they love, which is despair, hopelessness, mm-hmm. nothing can be done, mm-hmm. but realize that there's something in that in-your-face visibility of it that really is a mark of weakness and not of strategic sense.
Mm. I think it's useful to consider the fascist white supremacy, and they're one and the same, but, you know, fascism is different than white supremacist, quote unquote, liberal democracy. I think it's important to kind of look at fascism as, you know, like you said, a last ditch attempt, but specifically when violence is required to maintain the dictatorship of capital. We're seeing here in the US that the ideological kind of narrative is kind of collapsing in on itself. That happened too in Weimar Germany and then post-war Italy, where they respectively got Hitler and Mussolini. And we have that too in India with Modi, that, you know, the narratives, just as much as they were kind of bad at hiding what it meant, they were enough to maintain things in a, you know, semi-peaceful fashion. And now that's falling apart, and you need just overt suppression, either by the state or state supported, or state supported, and then it's kind of folded into the state repressive apparatuses. And that can really only go on so far. We've had this war on crime that it was mm-hmm. is incredibly brutal. You know, as unsuccessful as the DSA-backed defund the police was, the narrative of crime is through the roof, it's making us all unsafe, that's kind of failed by now.
Yeah.
So they're increasing all of these jail sentences. They're passing executive orders. They're doing a whole bunch of stuff to kind of maintain the project as is, because it still has support within the ruling class, but mm-hmm. not in the general public, where, you know, that becomes an actual problem. And that's when heads start to roll.
Yeah. Plus, they make so much money. I think it was Arizona that said they make so much money off of prison labor that it would destroy the state if they closed down the...
Yeah. I think they get paid like 50 cents an hour in Arizona.
That's more than I thought they would.
Yeah.
Here in California, they pay, I think it's like $5 a day to mm-hmm. go fight the wildfires. Yeah. They throw... Yeah. people into the fires, and then And then they can't become firefighters afterwards.
No. It's pretty weird to live in a country that runs on slave labor.
Yeah.
And it all ties back to how, you know, it's always really troubles me that Hitler was so inspired by America, and that I forgot what book it's called, but I guess he was reading the Jim Crow laws and he was like, oh, some of these are a little too much for me. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah, but it certainly you couldn't. I mean, too much. I mean, in terms of the criteria,
yeah,
the one drop rule, that is to say, if you have any African descent in you that we can see, we're going to call you black, mm-hmm, had very specifically to do with the maintenance of a big slave labor population, right?
Yeah.
So again, Hitler, there's this guy, Victor Klemperer, who's not like super leftist, but he was a scholar of French literature in like Weimar Germany. And then he's like, at some point I can't go to the library, at some point I can't this, whatever. And he like, but he survived. And he wrote what is sort of the classic book of what Nazism did to the German language. I would check out that book, because what he goes through, one of the things he says is this is very old fashioned, what he calls it, priestly deception. You know what I mean? And he's just like, Mein Kampf is the, I don't know what the phrasing he uses precisely is, but something to the effect of the sort of clumsiest, most obvious manual to priestly deception that has ever been written. Hmm. And it's very, very just like, here is how we can create a myth. I mean, very briefly, like part of the big problem that they have in Germany from the far right perspective is you don't have a unifying theological framework because of the competition, particularly of like Lutheran and Protestant politics on the one hand and Catholicism on the other. So a German deism articulated in hatred against Jews, he's like, this can sort of work to unify us. But it's very particular. And as you say, it can't afford to be as one drop rule-y as the as the US fanatics could.
Very intense.
I know. I feel like we all need a bath after this.
It's true. But this is the thing. Like, I think this is definitely sort of how I've been feeling for a while, especially with the contemporary stuff. But part of it is the reason they don't talk about it. Like, you take, say, Madison Grant, whose book Hitler referred to as his Bible. Take the Canadian Prime Minister. The Canadian Prime Minister in the 30s was quite enamored with Hitler. Like, they had a lot of, he really dug through like Richard Wagner's music, this like Germanic music mysticism through which you know, reach to the stars. I mean, in the same way that Carl Jung, who even people on the left seem to cite with respect, was like, I feel Nazism below my belt in mystical unity with Hitler. Ew. When I'm in Germany.
He said that?
Like, I'm just like, dude, anyway, talking of that.
Come on, talk about shadow selves.
If you're listening to this and you like Jung, you should stop liking Jung.
He's canceled.
Exactly, canceled. But some of what's really remarkable about it all is like, we don't have the intergenerational heritage to remind us who in the 30s knocked those people onto their asses.
Right.
But these guys got defeated. And what's been done, where the Anglos are really smart or historically, is not retreating any more than they need to, and then selling every inch of retreat they did as a measure not of the struggles against them, but of their sort of fanciful humanitarianism or something, right? Mm. Whereas the fact is, the reason that all this is, it's really messy, because setting aside the Hitlerian stuff, which, you know, made for a cataclysmic 12 years, but was a 1,000-year Reich that went down in 12 years and went down for reasons, the stuff that's incorporative becomes trickier because it relies on the brains and the activity of the people who are the objects of hatred. And at this point in history, you can't just turn back the clock. Like, the configuration of power is different. So I think that some of what, if we can find a way of like not being horrified and apocalyptic about it, but reconnecting with the analysis and the strength of the people who defeated these forces in circumstances that were in many respects less favorable.
Yeah.
Then I think there are ways of experiencing the years ahead in these reconfigurations in a way that's like, you know, realistic and frightened and horrified where we need to be, but also, you know, hopeful and realistic in the sense that what the liberals are trying to do is make us feel apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. But in some sense, that when their electoral system, which they've been using with smoke and mirrors against people, even with from pressure on the right, starts to come apart, that's not necessarily our problem. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's all this midterm, like, everyone drop everything, come help us save this from the Republicans so that we can Biden Cheney this. Like, what are you talking about?
It might be apocalyptic for them, but not for us. We know the way out. We know what we need to do to get out of this mess. That makes sense.
We do.
I'm like twinkling to the doubt in the voice. But anyway, you know.
We do.
It's all sorted. Right.
I like really appreciate this. Like, can you put together your like bibliography and email it to us?
But there's one thing that there's actually, I'll mention another one, which is what's really significant is that all of this is the same old trash as always, right? Mm-hmm. So it used to be like, you know, Joe Hill got shot by the copper boss, as we know, at their behest, for singing songs like Preach, or writing them like Preacher and the Slave, talking mm-hmm. about, it's not pie in the sky. You deserve a life that's decent. They can't just tell you live your misery and you'll be okay in heaven, right?
Yeah.
All of this stuff, though, gets recapitulated. And what's really significant is there's this huge surge of, on the one hand, making people crazy, but on the other hand, a sort of reactionary, here's how you can cope and opt out literature.
Mm.
And it's just in terms of the scope of the hiding of Nazism, for example, like, I'm not that deep in specialization, but it's on the, like, after Mein Kampf, the second most like official book under the Third Reich was this book called The Myth of the 20th Century, referring to the blood myth, which they're openly saying is made up mm-hmm. By this guy, Alfred Rosenberg. Now, I don't mean to be too direct in drawing this line of connection, but the epigraph on the front page of Rosenberg's book is dedicated to this guy, Meister Eckhart, an old Germanic mystic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here's how you should cope in prison and in misery and in poverty in the US mindfulness book promoted by the US corporate system is a book called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, who names himself after Meister Eckhart. It openly makes the same argument against reason, saying if you think too much and try to master your environment, it'll lead to horrors like the Chinese and the Russian communists did, right? This is a German Canadian mystic where we're like, indigenous children are buried in the ground here, and he's from Germany, and I think in the 20th century something might have happened in Germany, but in his review of the 20th century the problem is the Russians and the Chinese. And his footnote is Brzezinski. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So the way in which that sort of sucks or whatever, but to read, for example, Heinrich Heine, who Rosa Luxemburg and these others loved, and who Brecht tried to rewrite and who, you know, kicked it with Marx back in the day, Heinrich Heine's work on these theological deceptions is free on archive.org and super useful. So I think one thing that we need to do is just like not try to be too original, but just identify where the threats we face today are really just warmed up stuff from 50, 100, 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we can just like return to the stuff where it's already been outwitted rather than trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
Dan, what would you recommend people read at this moment?
Yeah.
I'm always looking for good books.
Lissordo. Domenico Lissordo.
Yeah.
Has a book about liberalism, which points out some, like, the fact that the last Liberal Party prime minister in Britain was praised by Hitler and then praised Hitler in turn is a sign. The fact that the word liberalism emerged from powers that were then, when the word emerged, in monopoly of the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans is another hint, but in very rigorous terms, but also accessible. Lissordo goes in liberalism through what that means. In another good books, very affordably sold by Verso, what's it called? It's about historical revisionism on the attack on the French Revolution and the Russian. And You know, the Nazi stuff is a big deal because the Reagan administration and Pat Buchanan and these guys started in the 80s to normalize, it's okay to glorify the Nazis a little bit, you know, like Reagan mm-hmm. went on that trip where they went and they laid wreaths at a cemetery with SS folk. But now that you've got the heroes of Mariupol with their like SS imagery, and the NATO position is supporting,
yeah, seriously.
Last week the guy had to resign from Germany because the NATO line is it's okay for the Ukrainian ambassador to be openly giving props to like local Ukrainian Nazi operatives, and they're like, dude, we still have to kind of pretend this is tough. Anyway, so Lasordo's book, it's called something like Revolution 20th Century. Those are keywords in it.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to go really like down this, he's got this really affordably sold from Haymarket, actually, tome of a book that's like 1,300 pages that claims to be on Nietzsche, but is really just like, with Nietzsche as a reference point, here's my sense of like the philosophy of the world. And it's really, anyway, all of which is to say that I think that in the US, Gerald Horn's
mm-hmm.
histories of racism and the detail they provide are second to none. And while there's a vast other chunk of stuff, I would say that like Lasordo's stuff for a Europe, like between Lasordo and Horn, I think we're pretty sorted. But I mean, there's other folk for sure.
Yeah, Horn's, I think it's called the Apocalypse series.
For a Jewish, since our Jewish name, it's cool because what it is he goes back, like his book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, is really good on the American Revolution, but then he goes back in a series century by century by century. And then at some point he's like, okay, dudes, I'm not going to be a medieval historian forever. Mm-hmm. I'm moving on. Yeah. Cool. But meanwhile, what he drops is his sense that the point of departure for a lot of the Anglo-racism that conquered the world was the 13th century expulsion of Jews from England in the days of when Chaucer's talking about how Jews have Satan in our heads or whatever. And Geraldine Heng has this book that goes through that. And like, it seems weird to be thinking about, say, the 13th century, but Heng goes through the myth of King Arthur, which is, you know, these days of the Jews have been expelled, we're killing the Saracens, we're trying to deal with this question of cannibalism because the Crusaders ate all these people, so we have to claim that there's a blood libel or somehow deflect that.
Wait, it's weird stuff. The Crusaders ate people?
Oh, very well established. So the Crusaders ate people.
So they were just projecting their blood libel onto Jews?
Oh, my God.
May we? And it's the same thing for slavery and for anti-Semitism and for all of this stuff.
I love how Dan said that. He was like, so yeah, they ate people. But the problem was,
But the thing is, they did lots of terrible things.
The problem was they didn't cook them properly.
But I do think there's a distinctive theological reason why, like, above and beyond, like, you know, witch burning and torture and all sorts of things that are equally horrifying in like, human terms, there was a distinctive theological trauma concerning cannibalism that was then central, as you say, to the blood libel and to all of the, and to the blood libel, which of course then is the point of departure for the myth of cannibalism when you get to the African and the indigenous cannibals and for this artistry of projection that has one century, you're the main slavers. The next century, you're colonizing Africa in the name of abolition. At one point, you're the main anti-Semites, the first in Latin Christendom to expel all the Jews. At the next, you're crusading against anti-Semitism in the Middle East. Like these, what are you talking about? Like the protocols of the Elders of Zion were Germany, US, Britain as their home. But now you've got these guys being like, it's just super, super artistry of projection stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it really ties in because in the 20th century, even the Arthurian myth is the template for, you know, for everything, frankly. Like the main British Empire lies from the most prestigious academics is from a thing called the Round Table. After World War II, US academics trying to serve the national security state is called Project Camelot. And anyway, so I do think that there's something happening right now where the way this is all becoming obvious and the communication system revolution, which really that we're living through equals like the birth of printing and some of its implications. It's insane that you can read any of this stuff for free in a couple of clicks.
Yeah.
And I think there's like things about that that's really cool.
I can't get over the cannibal stuff. I'm sorry.
No, but so the cannibal stuff that would get so weird, because what happens is the original Arthurian myth then has a way in which they maneuver the Saracens into like eating human flesh in this way that's ironic and like, yeah, there's really, really weird stuff, but that pushes into the 20th century. Because again, what Nazism is it's basically a part of the Romantic movement. That is to say, the rise of reason and a politics of rationality in the 18th century was in the 19th century met with the backlash of the Romantic movement. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Sir Walter Scott wrote these Ivanhoe and other stories. It was his language that the Ku Klux Klan then took. So the Klan is supposed to be like a Scottish Klan. They quoted Walter Scott on the fiery cross, which was an old Scottish symbol for the Klan stuff. Like, it's very, very open Scottish medievalism. But in the same way, Thomas Carlyle, when he's, for example, saying, don't listen to Heinrich Heine on Germany, he's just a blasphemous Jew, has really creepy stuff where he's like going by the Rothschilds with a pincer being like, I'll pull out these teeth, because of references in Walter Scott to the medieval ripping out of Jews' teeth. And Carlyle has like, you know, a lot of that sort of stuff. And I actually, I mean, as you say, showers and it's all really disgusting, but I do read myself into a lot of the focus on post-Holocaust teeth extraction.
I didn't even know that was a thing that you could research.
It's a big sub theme in like post-Auschwitz stuff.
Damn.
You're blowing my mind right now. I'm usually pretty talkative, but I'm just learning so much right now. The teeth stuff really bothered, like,
no, but Carlyle's teeth stuff. Yeah. Carlyle has some like really, again, Carlyle praised by Emerson as the undisputed English head of letters, his main work reviewed, which, by the way, like, he's not one of these idiots like Pat Buchanan where like you're like, I'm reading this because he's an asshole. You also do read him and learn, you know what I mean? Like, these guys were onto some stuff. Anyway, so like Thoreau during his time at Walden is reviewing Carlyle's work on the Taylor Patched, which is, again, I don't mean to babble too much, but like in the 1830s, we're looking at Hans Christian Andersen in Denmark writing about the emperor's new clothes and that notion of clothing and deception, which extends back to the age of disguise of Daniel Defoe and Jonathan Swift being picked up in the 1830s with this extraordinarily influential, freeonarchive.org, book by Carlyle, Sartor Resort, what is it? Latin, the Taylor Patched, Sartor is the first part of it. But anyway, and I think the Ku Klux Klan was directly pulling from that in their whole sheets iconography.
Yeah. Yikes. And now we have the Proud Boys and all the other, like, you know, current white nationalist groups, like, using Viking, like, mythology and symbology.
But so this is key, right? Crazy. So Emerson, in the Harvard Divinity Address of 1837, makes the point that a new politics of revelation is needed. But where the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Chinese and here the Christianity, of course, Jesus is Oriental, right? The idea for even Emerson is we need the Saxon heart to beat in our breast once more. So it's a key thing for the you know, Jack O'Dell, one of the communist associates of Martin Luther King Jr., made this point quite well in a YouTube talk online with Gerald Horn, among others, where he says, there's a myth that white power politics come from the American poor, but this was an elite project. And that elite, and the point he makes is that at the foundation of the American social sciences, the dominant theory was the Teutonic germ theory, the theory that Englishmen are all at their core Germanic whites. And what that meant was a shift to some extent, though really that maintained some Christianity in the form of, say, some Klan stuff, but into that was woven a very unchristian set of Germanic god references, where each time you hear the word Anglo-Saxon, one should remember that Saxony is, after all, in Germany. And the Norse gods, whether it's in Emerson or in Carlyle or throughout this Romantic period, as narrated for Netflix people on things like Last Kingdom, this idea that prior to Christianity, ours were the Norse gods. We are, you know, the people of Thor and Woden and all of this. That's basically mainstream social science in both England, the whole British Empire, and the United States into the early 20th century until World War I. When you're fighting the Germans, you're like, fine, you don't want us to be Germans. We know this is all make-believe. And at the switch of a switch, they just switch it. Like it's described as a secession from the Germanic race, where in the US and in Britain, there's a huge shift in the make-believe where everything up till World War I was English are Germanic superior whites. And then poof, it's all on archive.org, but it's nowhere in the newspapers because it's no longer useful.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. I have learned so much. So much.
There will be a take-home quiz. tomorrow morning.
Says Nora, whom I routinely salute. We've already, I feel like we've already discussed these details of command structure. I mean,
oh my gosh.
Oh man.
I know Prez is working on hopefully a fascism series, right?
Yeah, we're going to do it with Dan. I think that's the name he uses in his podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And we might have Justin back for part of it.
Yeah. So we got more books to read.
Yeah, classic books.
This could be like our kickoff episode for the upcoming series.
Yeah. Did you start those books yet, Talia?
No, but they are sitting by my bedside.
I have a stack of books like that too. I just kind of hope that, like, through osmosis in my sleep, I'll be able to.
Yeah.
I leave them at my
desk. I saw that spine 10 times. I'm sure I'm going to get
that. Exactly. I know exactly what it does.
What is the guy's last name? I can't pronounce
Polonsis.
It. Polonsis. Yeah, I got all three of his books. So
he's got some good stuff on, like, the class character of fascism and how to analyze it that I think is still very applicable today.
Mm-hmm. I like what Dan was saying, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
We could just go back and read what they were saying right then, because that's what everyone's learning from anyway. And Nazis aren't very, they aren't very creative.
It's true. And also the Nazis are the dumbasses of the group.
Yeah. You know what I
mean? Yeah. There are weak spots for sure.
I think that might be a good place to wrap it up, I think. Does anyone have any final thoughts?
My cat is purring loudly on my lap.
Aww.
I know. Yes, you're so sweet. No, other than check out the Electronic Intifada.
Oh, yeah, duh.
Electronicintifada.net. And I produce and co-host a podcast for EI, as well as I co-host a podcast with our good friend, John Elmer, at The Brief, which is at thebriefpodcast.com. Yeah, that's me.
Love it.
Thank you so much, guys. You guys are awesome.
Thank you.
Oh, this was fun.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I'm usually, like I said, I'm usually very talkative, but it was nice to be a learner. It just blew my mind, everything you were saying, especially the cannibalism.
I want to go back to that. That's amazing.
Not just because it's gross. One thing, because I think there's like a voyeuristic wow, like shock factor, but I do think it is the archetype for the projection that they pull on us on every single bloody issue, like slavery and anti-Semitism being two of the powerhouses, but like it extends to everything from writing style through every subject. And I think in that sense it's like significant.
I've always sort of avoided reading about the Crusades because it is so tied in with the alt-right and all of that. And I feel like I should probably educate myself more on it, because it's like you said, it sounds like the template for everything.
Yeah. Although I should, anyway, I feel like you want to wrap up soon, but I'll just say
you're
that,
fine.
Like, the romantic movement, again, Hitler's just super obvious with it. Mm-hmm. Part of the game is, Adam, if you have a moment of power, and, you know, Joseph Conrad's good on this. William James mm-hmm. Founds American psychology on this principle. History only happens in given moments. So if at a given moment you're told something happens 200 or 2000 years ago, it doesn't matter. It's still just a thought in your brain at a given moment. And what power should do is make itself felt to be eternal. And where it comes to someone like Hitler, he's so invested in it being obvious make-believe that it's like, okay, we want to be timelessly Germanic because that helps us be brutal in this way that shifts with Christianity. But what about the ancient times? Oh, no, it seems the Greeks are cooler then than let's say that we were Greeks anciently. I think a really sharp distinction needs to be drawn between the way that thousands of years of fake history are mobilized in a given moment and the actual details of thousands of years of history, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not true. The Brothers Grimm in the German romantic scene literally made stuff up. You've got fairy tales about torturing Jews and stuff, which you can again read in their like original fairy tale compilation. Mm-hmm. But what they did is very specific. They were hired by aristocrats. They wrote histories and they lied and said histories they had heard from the peasants. That was a lie, but it establishes a backstory in the same sense that Sir Walter Scott talking about timeless Scottish, you know what I mean? Like a la McGinnis and Proud Boys, timeless Scottish medieval history or whatever. It doesn't have to do with figuring out what actually happened 2000 years previously or 1000 years previously in medieval Scotland, which has nothing to do with this. And he doesn't know. It's a myth-making thing, right? So I think one can get really lost in this stuff, but there is the power of reason and rational thought from the bottom up. And there is the power of creative construction in which we all share. And in breaking apart the myths of the other side, it's good to look at their backstories, but one shouldn't take them literally in the sense that, like, again, these guys who are, you can use it on one direction and another. And I mean, I think a book that people really should read is when one sees Nazi bonfires in Berlin, let's say, we're supposed to look back with horror. I think a much better response is to say, what books are they reading? Are they burning? And how can I read them? You know what I mean? So the principal books that they burnt in the first major Berlin bonfire were raided from Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for the Study of Sexuality. Oh. And Hirschfeld's 1935 book, published posthumously in English, was one of the first books to use the word racism in the English language. And part of what's significant about it is he actually uses, without knowing what the Ku Klux Klan had been doing, the same imagery of the Scottish Highland Cross calling people to battle. But he used it to say, the peoples of the world will not abide by white supremacy for longer. In 1927, the Congress of Oppressed People met. This is a momentum that will grow from Africa through Asia, through the whole of the world. People will not stand for that dehumanization that in Holland and in Britain is so fanatical and is now trying to establish itself in Germany. And he uses this dramatic lightning imagery to describe the way in which anti-racist forces will rally and beat back the racists. So I think the fact that they take everything should just mean that we should take it back. So when we see them using evocative imagery, it makes less sense to naturalize that as something that is the enemy's and more sense to see how it speaks to a creative potential that can be exercised from the bottom up.
I think that's a very good place to wrap it up. That was really, really good. I'm so happy you guys came on.
So you're happy you have
me too. Yeah. Thank you so much. Let's do this again sometime.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to stop recording.
And I salute you.
Steht auf, ihr verwogelte Sklaven, ihr Brüder von Arbeit, steht auf. Es klingt schön von Aufstand der Waffen, es dunnert von Freiheit der Ruf. Vergesst auf dem lebenden Täten von Sores, von Hunger und Kälte. Gott sein seid ihr alle in Ketten, doch morgen gehört euch die Welt gegen Kapital und mutig sich gestellt. Der International von unserer Arbeit fällt gegen Kapital und mutig sich gestellt. Der International von unserer Arbeit fällt nicht kein Herrscher, wo sitzt eben, kein Gott, kein Kaiser und kein Gewirr. Genug zu hoffen und zu glauben, nicht ich verreich, Tover vor mir. Kidei befreien sich dem Eich, dem Geist die Hände im Arbeitsschweiß. Ihr kleibt zunächst dem ganzen Keich und Schmickels Mann, der Stoll ist heiß. Gegen Kapital und mutig sich gestellt. Der International von unserer Arbeit fällt gegen Kapital und mutig sich gestellt. Der International von unserer Arbeit fällt.
You have reached the very end, when them skies a bitter future may portend. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive, and our marching steps will thunder we survive. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive, and our marching steps will thunder we survive. Not late but blood inscribed this bitter song we sing. 'Tis not a caroling of birds upon the wing, but 'twas a people amidst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell. But 'twas a people amidst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell. Sorgen it keen mal as du gehst dem letzten Weg, den himmlen bleine verstellen bleue Teg. Weil kommen wetten noch unser eus gebänkter Schau, uns wetter Beugton unser Trott mir seinen Da. Weil kommen wetten noch unser eus gebänkter Schau, uns wetter Beugton unser Trott mir seinen Da. Geschrieben ist das Lied mit Blut und nicht mit Blei. Es ist nicht ein Lied von unserem Vogel auf der Frei. Das hat ein Volk zwischen Fahren dicker Wend. Das Lied gesungen mit einer Gamme sind die Hände. Das hat ein Volk zwischen Fahren dicker Wend. Das Lied gesungen mit einer Gamme sind die Hände.